Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the political upheaval in Greece, where parties on the far left and far right appear to be benefiting from the distress caused by austerity while offering rhetorical solutions to a growing economic crisis. A former US diplomat living in Greece, John Brady Keesling, joins us to discuss the angry mood in Greece, where many voters want to tear up the austerity deals with the EU and take their chances on defaulting, bringing back the drachma, and diving into a depression. Then we will speak with the former White House economic advisor, Jared Bernstein, who was Vice President Biden's chief economist. We will discuss what the White House can do to improve the economy in the face of determined Republican opposition to any stimulus, even though there is growing evidence that austerity policies are stifling growth and recovery in Europe. Then finally, we will speak with Tanya Lerman, an anthropologist who has done extensive fieldwork with religious evangelicals in the United States. Her latest book is When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. And she has an article in Monday's New York Times, Do As I Do, Not As I Say. Joining us now is John Brady Keesling, who worked for 20 years in the Foreign Service of the United States State Department. He resigned publicly from the U.S. Embassy in Athens to protest the damage done to U.S. interests and alliances by the George W. Bush's administration's foreign policy, particularly the war in Iraq. And he's remained in Greece since then. Mr. Keesling's latest book is Diplomacy's Lessons, Realism for an Unloved Superpower. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Brady Keesling.
Thanks for having me.
And I take it things in Greece are extremely unsettled since the election has now brought forth pretty much the extremes of the left and the right. And now the head of a left-wing party, Syriza, Alex Tsipras, has now been asked to form a government, and he is basically is going to reject the IMF EU bailout deal, which he's described as barbaric. So tell us what's the latest in terms of coalition forming and in terms of this political upheaval in Greece.
It's been a really depressing election. The results are mathematically about as bad as you can get. The election law was designed for a two-party system to make sure there was a stable government. The result in this case was the seat allocation doesn't reflect the mood of the public, and there's no clear message from the public of what they want, except that they want something they're not going to get. Tsipras, the head of Syriza, you know, the coalition of the radical left, has spent a few hours making brave declarations about how it's possible for Greece to go back to the good old days and somehow pay for everything, because Europe will come through in the end. But Europe is saying it's not going to come through in the end. And there is simply not enough coalition partners who believe Tsipras to form a government at this point.
And that includes the center-right New Democracy Party, right, of Antonis Samaras. They got the most number of votes, but they failed to form a government. Who is Tsipras talking to now?
Tsipras has talked to three of the small parties, and two of which are outside of parliament, and they say, sure, fine, we will support you. But he saved the difficult parties for tomorrow. He, in the meantime, made a statement essentially telling PASOK, the Socialist Party and New Democracy, that the only basis for a deal is if they send a letter to the European Union renouncing the previous agreements they had signed. And Samaras of New Democracy has come back and said, the hell we will. That would cause Greece to fall out of the euro and probably fall out of Europe. And he's made clear that's not a basis even for discussion. PASOK is much more flexible. They're saying we will, support a left government on the condition that they do nothing that jeopardizes Greece's remaining in the euro, which is what the Greek people say they want.
So Tsipras, could he form a government? Is there enough seats with the Democratic Left Party and the communists who so far have not backed him?
Basically, there aren't enough seats unless it would take all of the other parties in Parliament except for Crécy Avié, the neo-Nazi party.
That's Golden Dawn, right?
Golden Dawn, sorry, yes. I don't think it's going to happen. I'm pretty sure he's going to hand back the mandate tomorrow night and give PSOC a try.
Meaning what? That PSOC will have to try and form a government?
PSOC will then repeat the process of having 3 days in which to go to New Democracy and the other parties and say, here is our proposal for forming a government of national unity, which will keep Greece in the euro, but somehow begin a process of negotiating better terms or gentler terms with the European Central Bank, with the IMF, with the European Commission. PSOC has taken, I think, the most responsible stance of the parties in Parliament, but they know intellectually that the room for negotiation is very tiny, and Tsipras doesn't actually want to be responsible for the government right now in a situation of almost hopeless economic difficulties.
So you're in Athens as we speak. It's late there. I thank you for staying up to talk to us, Brady. So Tsipras, what you're telling us then is that Tsipras, this new party, Syriza, is just, it's all rhetoric and no reality, right? And does it necessarily reflect the Greek people? I mean, they're frustrated, but they're not entirely suicidal, right?
That's right. The Syriza came out of the Euro-communist movement in Greece. It used to be the most, civilized and interesting of the leftist parties in Greece. Unfortunately, there was a split where the grown-ups basically left, and Tsipras is head of a much more radical, much more populist movement. The percentage he got in this election reflects basically anger at the two large parties. Almost all of my younger friends voted for Tsipras's party, essentially saying it's the best way to send a message of rejecting, two generations of corruption. That said, it's not at all clear to me that they believe that Tsipras can do what he promises, which is give everyone full pay, full pension, full employment, and do it just by taxing rich people. Unfortunately, rich people in Greece, if you try to tax them, they just go back to London. So that's not realistic. Tsipras, to maintain Greece's old lifestyle, has to bring in lots of new money from Europe, and Europe does not have lots of new money to spend.
Well, they've spent $310 billion so far in bailing out Greece. There's a 30 billion euro installment due in June. And if Tsipras were in power and able to enact his policies, as you pointed out, I think it's pretty obvious that they'd be defaulting on the loans and essentially be kicked out of Europe and have to return to the drachma.
The good news here is that Europe traditionally is pretty understanding of domestic political convulsions. I think they will give Greece more time to solve this. The thing I'm sad about is I think everyone's already concluded that there's no room for a government with the current composition of parliament. They're going to try to go to new elections in a month and blame some other party for the fact that they've done so. And I'm not optimistic at all that new elections will change the picture enough to make the delay worth it. And then essentially at that point, they will have to confront reality, which is either deep austerity, which could be improved a little bit, or else leaving the euro and going into a deep and horrifying depression.
So obviously the choices are grim, and in those conditions, rhetoric is a balm against reality, I would think. And I'm, personally sympathetic to this party, Syriza, and their policies. And you say that all your young friends voted for them. I don't blame them. There's nothing good to be said about the previous governments and about the extent to which the Greek people are being squeezed, while the banks that made these reckless loans are not being held to account. So there's a, you know, one has some sympathy, but when you talk about the downside of defaulting, I guess the only example out there is Argentina, right?
Argentina defaulted. It's still having difficulties, but it was basically a much richer country in terms of natural resources than Greece is. Greece will always survive based on services it can provide in a globalized economy. I mean, tourism, shipping, things of that sort. Unfortunately, the promises that were made to the Greek people for two generations, really, and by both parties, both of the major parties, were so unrealistic. All of the difficult decisions were kicked down the road too long. You can only have a social welfare state that works if every once in a while someone comes in and makes it disciplined again, you know, cuts off the welfare cheats for a bit, so that you can have a healthy welfare system for everyone else, raise taxes at certain points so that you can lower them when you need to. You know, a common sense, a balanced approach, which fell out, you know, which never happened, which turned out to be politically too difficult, so no one did it. Now that you have a population that really just cannot face the horror that waits for it and is looking for magical solutions, Tsipras has offered them. These ultra-nationalists of two different parties have offered them. The two major parties are a bit more responsible in their rhetoric, but they're so deeply discredited that now that they've, you know, seen the light, no one believes them, and this is hard.
So is it a situation in Greece where you have welfare cheats on the left and, you know, non-tax-paying oligarchs on the right who are ready to fly out of town the minute that anybody asks them to pony up some taxes?
I would say that you have a whole political spectrum that is based on the idea that the state and Europe are cows to be milked by anyone who's clever enough to do it. The level of civic morality here is pretty low. The sense that everyone else is cheating is very high. And unfortunately, the response to that, which was to create this incredibly cumbersome state mechanism, it didn't make people honest. It just made everyone better at being corrupt. And so I'd take a libertarian view. You need to dismantle the Greek state and start over. That said, I would like, once it starts over, I would like there to be a Greek welfare state again, but it just, the reform process, it needs to be so sweeping, and the change of mentality needs to be so sweeping that it'll be a 10-year process, even if we're lucky.
So the recent efforts, I take it, by the last government to publish a list of the nation's biggest tax cheaters, who apparently included all of the big tycoons along with sports figures and entertainment figures, I take it that went nowhere.
A bunch of people were paraded to jail, and it made the public feel slightly better for a few minutes. But then, you know, the jails are already overcrowded, and they couldn't keep them. And one of the problems is the tax code is so absurd that the tax system is counterproductive in any case. The wrong people are asked to pay the wrong amount of money, and the government doesn't really know how much people should pay, so they charge arbitrary amounts and say, pay it or we will put you in jail, which isn't the best way to collect taxes. Greece would be much better off with a lower tax rate, but very strict enforcement of that rate. I don't see that happening anytime soon. There was one party calling for it, but it did not pass the threshold into parliament.
But Brady Keesling, you're telling us that this is a national kind of moral issue, that you this is a country that's been getting away with borrowing money and living high, and nobody much pays taxes, and there are lots of ghost jobs and ghost pensions and this kind of stuff. So give us a sense then of the reality check that's going on now, teetering on default, and the national dialogue. I mean, you know, it sounds a bit like what's required with Alcoholics Anonymous. The first thing you have to do in AA is say, you know, tell everybody in the world that you're an alcoholic and admit it. Is there going to be a come to Jesus moment here in Greece?
Sok has gone and made that statement. A few of the smaller parties have, and everyone else has derided them for it. People are still blaming George Papandreou of PASOK for going to the European Union and saying, sorry, it turns out our deficit was twice as large as we had told you before. And he was criticized for being naively honest, which got Greece into trouble, as opposed to being praised for confronting reality. The state of denial is huge. The only thing, to be fair, actually, per capita Greek debt is rather lower than per capita U.S. debt. We're behaving just as short-sightedly, we Americans, as Greeks are, just we have a larger economy, so it'll take a few more years for it to come and hit us upside the head. But at some point, any state has to balance its books more or less to survive. Greece was careless and greedy and had a too incestuous a political system for too long. Whether the U.S. system will take the lesson from Greece, the correct lesson from Greece, not the sort of the Republican aha lessons.
You mean austerity, the very thing that got them in the hole?
Yeah. Well, no austerity.
Well, austerity was a response
to good government. Yeah. Reducing government is good. I remember when Al Gore was reinventing government in the Clinton administration, and the State Department emerged from that stronger because we stopped wasting resources and had to use our brains instead. And that part is good, but simply, whacking everybody randomly, which is what the Greek state did, is catastrophically bad, and it doesn't work in the U.S. either.
Well, just in closing, Brady Kiesling, what about the role of Goldman Sachs in hiding Greek debt? And is that a big factor? I mean, there's no excuse for it. It's criminal. But how big a factor is it in this Greek debt disaster?
It's a pretty small factor. I resent the fact that to achieve a very short-term concealment of a few billion euros in Greek debt to meet some arbitrary EU targets, Greece had to pay hundreds of millions to Goldman Sachs in completely useless expense. But Goldman Sachs didn't cause the problem. The fundamental problem was an economy, people living beyond their means and not, borrowing money not for investment but for consumption. Goldman Sachs is, brilliant at making money off other people's stupidity, but it's not responsible for their being stupid, except on very rare occasions, and this wasn't one of them, I'd say.
And what about the German banks? Germany's been the beneficiary of the euro. They've expanded their export markets, and now they're basically adopting a kind of racist attitude. Well, you people in the South are lazy and you don't pay your taxes, and screw you.
Yeah, this is a very dangerous philosophy, and Mrs. Merkel has had to pander to that sentiment and for her own domestic electoral reasons, though she knows better in the end. Germany has benefited very much from the way the euro and the single market have worked. Germans sometimes forget that. The German technocratic establishment is fighting hard to save the euro and to save Greece within the euro, but they're doing it as much by stealth as they can because it's not popular among ordinary German citizens for logical reasons. The German banks, obviously want to be protected. So does the European Central Bank. So do the Greek banks. That's, you know, it's their business to be greedy, and it's the business of regulators to keep them from being as greedy as they want to be. The balance, I don't know where the balance is going to be struck. Greek banks at the moment are struggling to stay alive because they took a huge hit from the debt restructuring. So did Greek pension funds. You know, you cannot simply write off debt and have everything magically be easier, because most of the debt is owed to yourself in one way or another.
Well, Brady Keesling, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with John Brady Keesling, who worked for 20 years in the Foreign Service of the United States State Department. He resigned publicly from the U.S. Embassy in Athens to protest the damage done to U.S. interests and alliances by the George W. Bush's administration's foreign policy, particularly the war in Iraq, and he's remained in Greece since then. Mr. Keesling's latest book is Diplomacy's Lessons, Realism for an Unloved Superpower. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking to a recent advisor to the Obama administration's economic team.
Kiss me on a weekday, a weekday, a weekday's a day to be my guest. But never, never on a Sunday, a Sunday, a Sunday, 'cause that's my day of rest.
Just waiting for bread. Once I built a railroad, I made it run. Made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jared Bernstein, who's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 2009 to 2011, he was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. Prior to joining the Obama administration, Bernstein was a senior economist and the director of the Living Standards Program at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. And between 1995 and 1996, he held the post of deputy chief economist at the United States Department of Labor. He has an article at the Huffington Post, The Economy, Why We're Stuck. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jared Bernstein.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
And in your Huffington Post piece, you say basically suggesting that as the Europeans are repudiating, at least the French and the Greeks, repudiating austerity, we're here in this country still practicing, you know, what, 17th century medicine, bloodletting, and the use of leeches instead of modern medicine.
Right.
What is the impulse out there in terms of this willful economic illiteracy to ignore Keynes, because Keynes has been proven right. It's not an issue of his politics or the politics of behind his economics. Surely the track record is clear, isn't it?
It's probably not as clear as perhaps you and I think it is to a lot of other people. I think it's clear. But there are reasons, and they're not terrible reasons why others don't, and I'll speak to that in a second. But first of all, one thing that should be, alarmingly clear, particularly to politicians whose jobs are at risk, is that the anti-Keynes, austerity kinds of measures, demonstrably don't work. If you look at the countries that have implemented particularly spending cuts at a time when their private sector economies are yet to be back up and running, generating the economic activity people need to provide them with employment and incomes, those economies are getting worse by the day. And I think the electorates in some of these countries are very explicitly rejecting that. The point I was making earlier is that one of the things that drives a misunderstanding of these issues in our country here in the U.S. is that the Obama administration came into office, and I was working for them then, and we implemented a large Keynesian stimulus program, and the economy got worse. That leaves us explaining, which is true, but how it would have gotten even worse had we not taken the steps we did. But that's not an easy thing for people to wrap their heads around, the idea that, yeah, unemployment went up to 10% at its worst point, but it could have gone up to 12%. Lots of independent analysts have corroborated that kind of analysis, but still, I can see where people aren't ready to necessarily embrace that.
But Jared Bernstein, what kind of tools are in the toolbox? I mean, if you've got a Congress that opposes the president, and they have from day one, and now they're in the majority, and you've got a presidential candidate who's signed off on the Ryan budget, which is the opposite of stimulus, and it would seem to me that, you know, just to touch on the historical record a little, FDR at one point reversed a little bit of the stimulus and tried to have austerity, and it didn't work out. And clearly, a student of the Depression is now the head of the Fed. Does Bernanke have any tools? If the Congress aren't listening, without getting into cynical reasoning of why they're not listening, but it's pretty obvious it's an election year, what tools are in there for the president and for the chairman of the Fed to use?
I will speak to that. It's a good question. Let me just quickly, though, riff off of this idea that you just said it's an election year. I think that's right, and certainly, obviously, it goes without saying that politics is a huge player here. However, there do seem to be some signals from around the globe that the electorate will hold you responsible if you pursue austerity measures to the point where their lives are quite negatively affected by them. So, the politics may be a little bit more complicated than the folks who simply want to block helpful measures are viewing them. You're right that the monetary policy that the Federal Reserve engages in, that's their setting of interest rates generally. There's some other things they can do. They can buy different types of debt throughout the economy. But basically what they're doing is targeting interest rates, trying to get interest rates down so that the cost of borrowing, whether it's short-term or longer-term borrowing, the cost of borrowing, including mortgages, that's another type of borrowing, goes way down. Historically, that's one of the exit routes from a recession. The Federal Reserve takes those actions, lowers the cost of borrowing, and investors and consumers and households get busy realizing some of the demand that was untapped during the recession. That mechanism is less effective right now. One of the reasons it's less effective is because it often works through a housing channel. We already have an overhang in the housing market, and lots of people are quote deleveraging, meaning that they're spending down their debt levels. They're trying to get their own kind of household balance sheets back in order. So the interest rate tools that the Fed is wielding is useful, and it's helping a bit, but it's not helping as much as it should. What you really need in order for this monetary policy, low interest rates, to gain traction is more fiscal activity, more action on the spending side, in the Keynesian view that we were talking about earlier. Now, here you have Congress blocking the president. In fact, the president's out just today. The president was in Albany, New York, talking about a set of new ideas. Actually, they're not new ideas. A set of ideas he's been espousing for a while, ever since he presented the American Jobs Act almost a year ago now. So he's still trying to talk about ideas that would help, very much in the spirit of what I just mentioned, ideas that would help stimulate more growth and perhaps gain more traction from the low interest rate monetary policy side. But Congress is blocking him, and I suspect will continue to do so. So what can he do? Well, the only real thing that I think they can do that might, again, have some traction would be very much in this housing space. There's some things they can do in housing finance that would help create more loan modifications to people, maybe write down the principal on the home loans of some people who are underwater. I think that would help a bit. But without Congress and the purse strings, hard to do much.
Again, I'm speaking with Jared Bernstein, who's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 2009 to 2011, he was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. He has an article at the Huffington Post, The Economy, Why We're Stuck. So if the House is blocking it, either for p- political reasons. I mean, I don't know whether it's too cynical to accuse them of letting the economy get worse in order for them to get reelected. And that may well apply to the presidential candidate, of course, who's basically running on the notion that as a business executive, he is more qualified to fix the economy. If the economy were fixed, then he wouldn't have a lot to say. The long and the short of it is, ideology aside, what about corporate America? They're having record profits now, particularly in the oil and gas sector. There are other parts of the economy, though, surely, that need demand. When I talk to businessmen, they always say, look, we don't care about tax cuts. That's nonsense. It's got nothing to do with stimulating demand. What we need is people to have money in their pockets so they can buy our products. What about that constituency? Can the president activate that constituency?
I think that he needs to try. You're right. If you want to look to one sector that's doing well, it's the corporate sector, largely because these are folks, especially if they're connected to multinational industry firms that can sell into markets abroad that are doing better than ours, and they've been highly profitable. But yes, domestically, as long as households are struggling, we mentioned this deleveraging cycle with people paying off debt. We also still have job market problems, of course, very high elevated unemployment rates and paychecks that are falling behind inflation for a lot of people. And that just doesn't help much on the spending or the consumption side. By the way, we're getting a little boost now because gas prices have come down a bit, and that's been very helpful. But still, people need to have a more robust labor market generating more income, more earnings. That, in turn, would create greater demand for the kinds of goods and services that businesses throughout this country want and need to sell. Absent that kind of demand, you're absolutely right. You can lower interest rates all you want. You can cut taxes all you want. But if we are still a 70% consumption economy, and if people aren't out there engaged with businesses, then not much is. It's pretty hard to get out of the slog that we're in.
So, what's the explanation then, Jared Bernstein, for the Ryan budget and the ideology behind it, which the president refers to as thinly disguised social Darwinism?
I think that the explanation has very little to do with these kind of economic cyclical dynamics. We've been talking about the fact that the economy is still trying to climb out of the Great Recession, and the president is still trying to push ideas that would help create more demand and do exactly the kind of things we need right now. I think that what you see from, for example, the Paul Ryan budget is a vision of government in people's lives that is very much de minimis. Government plays a much smaller role than certainly I believe is healthy for an economy, and I think probably most people would agree if they took a close look. Things like Medicare, okay, this is the retirement security program. I mean, health insurance program for retirees. Now, these are people who are past their working years, and it's long been decided that a useful role for government is providing health insurance for older people like that, because this is very much a public function. If they're not working, how are they going to get health insurance, especially if they're people of modest incomes? And by the way, the median income of the typical Medicare recipient is about $25,000. But the Ryan budget does tremendous damage to this program. Same thing with education and training. Same thing with the safety net programs that help less advantaged people when the economy turns south. Things like nutritional programs or the anti-poverty measures we have. But same thing with infrastructure, investment and research. I mean, this is really shredding government back to, you know, its most fundamental roles. Just provide, you know, defend the coasts and not a lot more. And that may be, well, I mean, he's perfectly welcome to go forth and see if that's a vision that Americans will support right now. But certainly the work that we've been doing here at the Center on Budget is at least trying to make it very clear what we would sacrifice if we would go down that road.
But Jared Bernstein, in your article at the Huffington Post, The Economy, Why We're Stuck, you point out the disparity here between the political right and the political left in this country, that the right have got wealthy people paying for the think tank research and the politicians that prevent these progressive policies, including the Keynesian stimulus. And all they've been pushing is high-end tax cuts for the 1%. And after all, we have a 1% running for president on the Republican side. I mean, it strikes me as extraordinary that people are buying that. And, you know, I think Romney's got at least the polls indicate he's got a pretty even chance of becoming the next president. So obviously you can't make up that deficit in think tanks and right-wing infrastructure that the Democrats lack. What is going to make it up, it would seem to me, is some good messaging, and I don't see it yet.
Well, I'm an economist, and obviously a political economist. I've worked in government, I've worked in the think tank world. I didn't study messaging, so I'm not sure I'm the right person to answer the question. I do have this blog. By the way, the piece that we're talking about first showed up on my blog, jaredbernsteinblog.com. And the whole purpose of that endeavor, and I spend a fair bit of time posting to the blog, trying to inform folks in reader-friendly language about these issues. And that's my only, that's the only way I know of advancing the debate forward. I obviously one little dude with one little blog isn't gonna change the world, but I am one of a chorus of voices. I would add, obviously, Paul Krugman's kind of the conductor, but there's lots of other people in the chorus who are trying to bring fact-based analysis to, I would say, fact-based and values-based analysis to the issues we've been discussing. Again, I would say, and I probably have to leave it here, but I would say, look at Europe, because you really can't fool all the people all the time. And I'm not saying that what's transpiring in Europe is a clear path forward. We don't really know what's going to happen. I think Hollande, the new French president, certainly has been talking an anti-austerity agenda, but we'll have to see what he's got to back it up. But eventually, if I'm right in some of the points you've been amplifying, Ian, if we're right about this, then chickens will come home to roost, and people will recognize that their interests have not been met by those who've been distorting the facts and the reality of these policies. In the meantime, I'm just going to continue to try to talk about this in ways that I hope resonate with people.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Jared Bernstein.
You're welcome.
Again, I've been speaking with Jared Bernstein, who's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 2009 to 2011, he was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. He has an article at the Huffington Post, The Economy, Why We're Stuck. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with an anthropologist who argues that secular liberals in this country need to know how to talk to the religious right.
Be constructive.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tanya Lerman, who's a professor of anthropology at Stanford University and the author of When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. She has an article in Monday's New York Times, Do As I Do, Not As I Say. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tanya Lerman.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
And your book, and to a lesser extent your article, goes a long way to answer a question that's always I've found extraordinary, is that why the Democratic Party, obviously the Republicans, get elected on, rely upon or depend upon peeling off Democratic votes, working Americans who vote Republican, and who, the assumption is that they're voting against their interests, but then the Democrats don't do anything about it, but sort of feel churlish and dismissive. And you're saying that they're missing out on a huge bet here.
Yes. I think that one of the, what Democrats do when they talk about politics, they think about the outcome of their policy choices. So they think about changing social circumstances so people can be as they are and the thing, and things will go better for them. And the language that I hear in evangelical settings is a language not only about morality and character, but of transformation, changing yourself as you do deeds for other people. And I think it would help the Democratic Party if they were to adopt some of that language themselves. I think, you know, it's actually not so far from what many Democrats believe, but this sense that it's about the way that you grow through good action and become a better person, and the action is intended to help other people become better people. It's a very different way of thinking about what counts.
Well, it seems, though, that since you did such extensive field work amongst religious evangelicals here in the United States, in your new book, When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God, was that your intention going in? It sounds to me like you went on a learning experience here.
Yes. I mean, I knew that I was just curious about what people meant when they said that they heard God speak to them. I met this young woman who was just kind of a giggly beach Californian, and she said if I wanted to understand her church, I should have coffee with God. And I was floored by that. I wanted to figure out what she meant, how she had that experience. I thought about religious belief much more in terms of propositions, not so much as a relationship and experience. And it was an eye-opening experience of also understanding how varied the evangelical world can be.
Well, notwithstanding the old joke that if you talk to God, you're religious. If God talks to you, you're a schizophrenic.
That's right.
But this is real, though. That's the point that you're making here, that these are real conversations and a real engagement that people have. And by the way, yesterday I spoke with Sister Simone Campbell, the head of Network. She's the head of the Catholic Sisters in this country, who the Pope singled out as being a radical feminist and chastened her to get back to the church doctrine and preach about abortion, contraceptive, and in support of abortion, contraceptive, and the male priesthood. And, of course, the notion that that a nun who had taken a vow of celibacy should speak about contraception struck her as being amusing. But the long and the short of it was, she spoke quite matter-of-factly about praying when we talked about the healthcare bill and the possibility of the Supreme Court stripping out the heart and soul of it. You know, she said, "Well, I'm just praying. I'm just praying." You know, it was so real to her. So I get what you experienced.
Yeah, I mean, I don't pass judgment on whether God is real or not real, or whether God shows up in these conversations. But what I can say is that people they sometimes come to the church very confused by what it means to hear God speak back. But what they develop is a way of recognizing their own thought experience, so that these conversations with God that they're having in their mind feel very real to them. That feels as if they're not just talking to themselves, but talking with an external being. I mean, I should also say that they're pretty thoughtful about this. They know perfectly well that when they're talking with God in their mind, they can be projecting a lot of their own desires, and so they need to be really careful about what they interpret God as saying back. And yet it's a sense of, it is a real relationship.
And you also point out that in these evangelical churches where you did your field work, you met doctors, scientists, and professors, and a lot of the people you met cared about social justice.
Yes. So I thought the the folks I met were a lot smarter than many secular liberals imagine them to be. And they are much more involved with helping those who suffer than many secular liberals caricature them as being. You know, evangelical spirituality is a pretty broad sweep of American culture. So there are all kinds of people in there, but the stereotype that many people have is just pretty limited.
Well, obviously, we've experienced an evangelical candidate. In fact, a number were competing for the Republican ticket on the basis of their religiosity. But of course, undoubtedly, the most authentic was Rick Santorum. And you're suggesting that when he talks about virtue, that in fact that is not something to ridicule, that's something to emulate.
Yes. I mean technically he's Catholic, but he certainly speaks, he grabs the attention of the evangelical world. And he said in a very kind of much derided comment that the problem with government is that you go into the inner city and people are not virtuous, and there is government. And he was really inviting you to conclude that government only steps in when people are immoral. I think that whatever you make of that comment, it's really helpful to represent government action as not being this, you know, the backstop for immoral people, but rather that in reaching to help people in pain, we grow together as a nation and we move towards a more moral character.
So, in other words, that extends, for example, to the Obama health care, which has been badly sold or not sold at all. You're suggesting, again, Tanya Lehrman, a professor of anthropology at Stanford University and author of When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. What you're suggesting is, in terms of the so-called Obamacare, is that the president should be describing his health care reform as a response to suffering, not as a kind of numbers-crunching solution to an economic problem.
That's right. And even when he talks about the suffering of individuals, it should not be only about their bankruptcy and only about the difficulty of the insurance. It should be about the fact that they need our help because they are in pain. And I think if he also used a language about how we grow in care and compassion, it would help to reach more people. It's not going to reach everybody. It's not going to reach all evangelicals. But this language of how political action is something that we do to grow ourselves as in our nature, that's the way that many evangelicals imagine their moral responsibility to be.
So how do you then educate secular liberals to approach evangelicals in the way that, if you were sort of an advocate for the Democratic Party, I mean, you know, the notion that the Democratic Party is anything but the old joke of Will Rogers, that I don't belong to any organized political party, I'm a Democrat. I've witnessed that firsthand. They're not particularly well organized, that's for sure. So, but how would you, if you had to write a handbook for them, what would your first bullet point be?
Well, first would be respect the evangelicals. They're not, you know, many of them are very smart and sophisticated. They are, many of them share the general goals that the secular Democrat holds, and speak in a language of, I mean, spiritual transformation may be too hard for many secular liberals to be comfortable with, but speak in a language of how we develop care and character as we vote, as we help, as we choose policy to intervene in people's lives.
So why do you think it is that we had in this country a religious left at the time of the last Gilded Age, given that we're in many ways in the second Gilded Age with the disparity of wealth at extraordinary levels, and in many ways one could question the extent to which we are still a democracy and have in fact become a plutonomy ruled by oligarchs, but that's another discussion. But the long and the short of it is that during the days of William Jennings Bryan, of course famous for the Scopes trial, he was the Democratic Party standard bearer against the plutocrat, or the candidate of the plutocrats, McKinley, and he was outspent 200 to 1 or something. But he had this tremendous coalition of urban poor and rural poor who were galvanized by his preachings, the cross of gold, etc. What happened to that movement, and why did it become the movement that it is today, which is clearly very much identified with the Republican Party?
I think the story actually is rooted in the 60s, and the origins of the evangelical worlds that I saw lay in the hippie Christians, and that world was a very left-wing world. That was a powerful movement. American spirituality changed pretty significantly in the 60s, and we've had other times when the Americans have sought to experience God directly and immediately, but the change from the 50s was pretty dramatic at that point. And evangelical Christianity became a new thing, and about half of those really wanted an intimate personal relationship with God. I think it's partly an accident that it became so right-wing. So there were a couple of sharp and clever politicians who were right-wing who began to move the evangelical agenda politically to the right by focusing on issues of the family and reproductive rights. So abortion and gay marriage have been the two key moral issues that have galvanized that kind of right-wing tilt. Like Ralph Reed was one of these. And that they became the kind of, those issues became the standard bearers for voting in a particular way, and they became the lead issues. And that movement was sort of swept off to the right. Now the tension between the two sides has become just exacerbated by being exacerbated. And there is so much caricature and hostility and stereotyping of each other that conversation just become difficult to have.
Well, the sister I was speaking with yesterday, Tanya Lerman, her main defense was that the accusations from the Pope and the Vatican against her and the sisters in this country were about politics, not about faith, and mm-hmm. that she considered a badge of honor that she was ministering to the poor, which is the whole point of the example of the prophet Jesus. And I'm just wondering why it is that that can't be more ammunition for an incipient religious left, the fact that the person that everybody follows was clearly, he didn't carry an AK-47 and hate homosexuals and go on television and shake down poor people for money. I mean,
if Democrats were willing to use that language, I think it would be really more effective. And if they were willing to use the language also not only about helping the poor, but growing in spirit as you do so. There's actually, a quarter of white evangelicals voted for the Democratic ticket that last time around.
You're talking about 2008, for yeah. President Obama.
Yeah. And I think that the old kind of coalition, on the one hand, there's more polarization. On the other hand, you see the many evangelicals breaking with the expectation that they should vote for the Republican ticket. But they need to be, I think it's easier to talk with them if one could use a language from the Bible. I think Mr. Obama would be comfortable doing that. and also using a language that talks, I mean, he could talk to the entire country and talk about how we could grow together as a nation. And that, just that language, I think, is a more comfortable invitation than kind of, it's the economy, it's the economy, it's the economy.
So I guess in a way, you're a voice against the, in a lot of in our popular culture recently, we've had Hawkins and Hitchens and others have been questioning faith or dismissing it. And you're suggesting, as an anthropologist, I mean, is what you're telling us informed by the other work that you've done? I've assumed that you've done other field work in other countries. It seems to me that the more that you study humanity and from urban to the tribal, there's always a God somewhere. I suppose in our culture it's more monotheistic, and in so-called primitive cultures it's more pantheistic. But is there a connection there?
I think when you're an anthropologist, you're thinking about how other people understand their world. And it's not about saying what you think is true. It's about thinking about how other people hear. And so the challenge of communicating so that people hear is a very anthropological issue. I don't think that's what the new atheists are thinking about. And my thoughts, how can you not take religion seriously? You know, 3 out of 5, maybe even 3 out of 4 Americans pray daily. This is something that really matters to people. And it's not just a dumb mistake. I mean, whatever is the case about the real reality of God, if people are taking this so seriously, they're, you've got to take it seriously as an important social experience. And we know that it's good for you. I mean, the studies suggest that going to church on a weekly basis adds 2 to 3 years to your life, makes people happier. People who have a good relationship with a loving God are less vulnerable to mental illness. I mean, your immune response is better. Your inflammatory response is lower. It's in so many ways, there is a pile of evidence that suggests that religion is a healthy buffer against the world. You know, people, you got to take that seriously.
Well, you're on a very left-wing radio station, I have to tell you.
No, I mean, I'm not saying that people should become Christians.
I'm suggesting, Tanya, that I'm going to get run out of town, not you.
No. I just think that, you got to respect people who have made this decision and that it's helpful to figure out how to talk to them rather than to make fun of them or to dismiss them. And, and that people know more evangelicals than they realize. Secular Democrats know more evangelicals than they realize.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today. It's a pleasure talking with you, and I hope we can have a follow-up conversation.
I'd like that. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Tanya Lehrman, a professor of anthropology at Stanford University and the author of When God Talks Back, Understanding the American Evangelical Relationship with God. She has an article in Monday's New York Times, Do As I Do, Not As I Say. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.